flight muscles, calculated their bearing by the position of the sun, and then resumed their journey. After crossing the southern border of Texas, the eastern monarch population merges into a flyway about 50 miles wide. During this leg of their migration south, they follow the geography of the Sierra Madre Oriental mountain range. Then near a region called the Sierra Gorda, they abruptly change direction and cut through a pass heading southwest toward the interior of Mexico.
And there they find the end of the desert and the start of a transverse mountain range that runs west-east, and that's the Transvolcanic Range.
The Transvolcanic is the tallest range in Mexico. Its mountains contain rich deposits of heavy metals that may play an important role in the monarch's navigation.
Gold, iron, manganese, copper, all of these metals created an anomalous magnetic field. And this seems to be important in bringing the monarchs in, because the monarchs have tiny particles of magnetite, the mineral magnetite in their body, at the base of the wing and in the thorax and abdomen. And these are believed to help them navigate to precisely this mountain range, because there's a very strong magnetic anomaly as one approaches this range due to all these heavy metals near the surface. So the particles of magnetite rotate like a little bar magnet inside a cell, and that cues the monarch that needs to head in a certain direction.
Until late in the 20th century, the only people to ever observe the butterfly's arrival in Mexico were the farmers and miners who lived and worked in these volcanic mountains. Then, on January 2, 1975, in a forest 70 miles west of Mexico City, a spectacular discovery opened the door for the rest of the world. Of monarch butterflies had gathered in a forest of oyamel firs 10,000 feet above sea level. Frederick Urquhart, a Canadian biologist who devoted his career to the search for this colony, described it as a glorious, incredible place where butterflies swirl through the air like autumn leaves, shimmering against the mountain sky and drifting across our vision in a blizzard of orange and black. Science now glimpsed the true magnitude of the Eastern Monarch's migration.
One of the really remarkable things about this migration is that all of these individuals have never made the trip before. It was their grandparents or great-grandparents two, three, four generations ago. They have no leader who's made the trip before, unlike whooping cranes or sandhill cranes. They don't have an older, experienced adult to take the lead and show them where to go, where to stop at night. But in the end, it ends up on the very same trees, same area, same slope of the mountain that its parents and grandparents left from the previous year.
Since 1975, a dozen permanent overwintering colonies have been discovered in these mountains. Each maintains a critically balanced microclimate that helps sustain the monarchs until spring. Average temperatures in the colonies range from 35 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit, warm enough to protect the insects from freezing, and cool enough to minimize their expenditure of energy. For more than 4 months, Hundreds of millions of butterflies live in a state of semi-hibernation while slowly consuming the reserves of nutrients they accumulated during the summer. The bark and needles on the fir trees provide stable footholds, and by flocking in roosts several layers deep, they can endure days or weeks of inclement weather. With the arrival of spring, the insects prepare to depart the overwintering sites. After the sun warms the colony, the monarchs leave their roosts for a few hours each day. They travel short distances in search of nectar and water that will nourish them during their journey north. At lower elevations, they feed on the new bloom of wildflowers and draw moisture from the damp grass and the rivulets that run down from the mountains. The lengthening days also trigger a change in the monarch's biology. In early March, the butterfly's reproductive organs become active, as the males produce sperm and the females eggs. After mating, they leave the colonies and head north, ready to establish a new generation. The monarch's departure from Mexico coincides with the appearance of a new crop of milkweed in southern Texas. When the females find the host plants, they lay their eggs. Their life cycle now complete, they will soon die. Throughout the spring and summer, successive generations of monarchs, each living about 4 weeks, follow the milkweed as it grows progressively across the Midwest and into southern Canada. Then in late August, near a dairy farm in Minnesota or a lakeshore in Ontario, butterflies from a new Methuselah generation emerge, ready to undertake the great migration once again.
The series of steps that the monarch takes during this trip, both coming south and going north again in the spring, is truly astounding. Here's an insect moving by the billions between three countries. To imagine a tiny brain the size of a monarch brain being able to carry all the information that it needs to make this 2,500 mile trip, adjusting daily for the movement of the sun as it drops lower on the horizon, getting near the overwintering site in Mexico and somehow ending up in the same mountain range that their grandparents came from the previous spring. But that tiny brain puts all of this together. It is a wonderful mystery. It's going to attract scientists' attention for many, many decades or centuries to come. And we are only beginning to understand how miraculous this is.
It's impossible to look at a caterpillar turning into a butterfly and not ask how. Their metamorphosis, their migration, their life cycle. How did this happen? How is it regulated? How is it controlled? This astonishing, remarkable transformation. A biologist who encounters a puzzle-like metamorphosis is going to view that puzzle through an analytical filter, a lens. It's a way of trying to understand the problem. And for most biologists, that lens is going to be an undirected evolutionary process.
Since the late 19th century, most explanations for the life cycle of a butterfly or any other organism have shared a basic premise. To be considered scientific, they must rely exclusively upon undirected natural causes. This view was first published by Charles Darwin in his Theory of Evolution through Random Variation and Natural Selection. And today, it is widely accepted as a foundation of modern biology. But can such a theory account for the origin of metamorphosis?
On the evolutionary view of life, in particular on the Darwinian view of life, everything that an organism does, every feature that it has, all of its details ultimately relate to the requirements of natural selection. So to build the first butterflies, natural selection would have had to work entirely through genetic mutations. They're the raw materials of evolution.
A mutation is an error in the DNA of a living organism, an alteration of the genetic code. The theory of natural selection contends that the accumulation of mutations over enormous periods of time fuel the evolution of all complex life on Earth.
Generally speaking, mutations are mistakes. It's a change to the DNA, and these mutations happen in a random way. They're not guided or directed to happen in the right order, in the right sequence, in the right time.
There's no foresight involved in this process, no vision of what the organism needs in the future. Now, there's a real problem with that, especially when you consider the single most important element of metamorphosis, the chrysalis.
A butterfly chrysalis connects two fundamentally different ways of living. It is both a bridge and a workshop, where one type of organism is transformed into another. The magnitude of this transformation has been compared to a Model T Ford that suddenly encases itself within a garage. Inside, most of the car breaks down into fragments of metal, rubber, and glass. These pieces then reorganize themselves into components more complex than any that previously existed in the Model T. After several days, the garage door bursts open and a radically different mode of transportation lifts off into the sky.
Now, an analogy like that is pure whimsy. But even if it were somehow possible, I don't think turning a car into a helicopter would be nearly as impressive as the actual transformation that takes place inside a chrysalis.
From the moment the chrysalis is formed, caterpillar tissues are destroyed and then recycled to help build wings, compound eyes, reproductive organs, and navigational systems of stunning beauty and efficiency. Yet despite the importance of cell death in the chrysalis, the origin of the process defies the basic logic of natural selection.
One of the fundamental requirements of natural selection is reproduction. You've got to be able to make copies of yourself, in particular of your genes. You've got to be able to pass them on. But a chrysalis, unless it represents a bridge to something yet to come, is really a casket. If you're a caterpillar, you're entering your own grave. Turning most of your body into a molecular soup would be suicide.
A caterpillar, unless it makes it through to the adult, is no good because it can't reproduce. You're not going to have offspring, and so you're a dead-end street evolutionarily. So it wouldn't be any benefit at all to kill yourself unless you've got a hidden plan up your sleeve. You know, like, okay, I know I can go ahead and commit suicide because there's a new me waiting to happen.
The caterpillar is not going to enter the chrysalis without simultaneously knowing, I've got a plan for getting out of this. I'm heading towards the adult butterfly. I'm going to reconstitute these tissues in the adult form, emerge, and go on my way. But that's not how natural selection operates. It can't look into the future and somehow anticipate what an evolving organism is going to need in a week or a month or 1,000 years from now. So if the first caterpillars were evolving into existence, without foresight, it's highly unlikely natural selection would retain a destructive process like cell death.
This absence of foresight is not the only challenge to Darwinian theory. Biologists have long recognized that natural selection cannot succeed by taking large evolutionary leaps. Instead, the process can only move forward through a series of small, incremental steps.
In evolution, it's the smaller scale changes that have a better chance of being passed on because they're relatively limited in their scope. That means they're disrupting less, and they're more likely to be tolerated by the organism. But when it comes to the origin of metamorphosis, the notion of gradual evolutionary change comes to a dead end.
By its very nature, metamorphosis is an all-or-nothing proposition. And throughout biological history, its success is hinged upon the immediate availability of a full set of instructions, including genes, proteins, and the developmental program required to integrate them.
It all has to be in place ahead of time. It needs to have the genes in place, the regulatory elements that are going to turn the genes on and off. It has to have all the cells pre-programmed to do what they're going to do when the time comes so they respond to the signals they get in the right way. The larval cells have to know they're going to die. You got to remember the caterpillar isn't thinking about things. It's not saying, okay, now it's time to dissolve my epidermis, and okay, what about that gut? Got to get working on that gut. No, it has to happen rapidly and in a coordinated fashion. Once you're committed to the chrysalis stage, there's no going back. You have to complete the transition.
A caterpillar that's equipped to go 10% or 25% of the way through metamorphosis is no way through metamorphosis. Part way into a process that requires getting out the other side as a fully formed adult doesn't work.
You have to recreate adult legs, adult antennae, adult eyes. You have to change the shape of the brain and the connections between the antennae and the eyes. You have to reformat the gut so that it switches from eating plant material to eating nectar. How many mutations does it take, and how do you coordinate all of that? If you get the eyes right, but the gut wrong, it's a failure as a butterfly. If you get the wings right and the legs right, but the muscles don't attach, that butterfly's going nowhere. It's dead. You begin to see the depths of the problem. So for evolution to have created this sort of pathway gradually, it would take a miracle.
Metamorphosis, if it came into existence at all by an undirected process, had to have done so in one fell swoop. Natural selection, by definition, I would say, cannot build that kind of process. To create a process like metamorphosis, you'd need a totally different type of cause. Something that could see a distant target, keep that target in focus, and provide all the resources necessary to hit the bullseye on the first shot. I think the only cause that could have accomplished that is an intelligent agent.
From a philosophical perspective, the suggestion of intelligent design as the explanation for the origin and development of life contradicts the assumptions of many biologists. But when considered objectively, evidence may be plentiful within the walls of a chrysalis or on a monarch's wings.
Metamorphosis not only challenges the Darwinian picture of life, in fact, it points in a positive way to the truth of intelligent design. If you saw a mechanical device of the sophistication of a butterfly, you would not for a moment hesitate to ascribe that to intelligence, because the butterfly is so much more sophisticated, almost beyond our comprehension, than anything that we make. Planning, foresight, artistry, engineering. Normally, in our experience, when we see those criteria fulfilled, we see those indicators, we say that's positive evidence of intelligent design. To build a butterfly, you need a cause that can visualize a long-range objective, and then direct every step of the process that's required to make it happen. Only intelligence, universally in our experience, is capable of doing that. You also need a cause that can reuse lower-level component parts to construct a different, higher-level system. For butterflies, the same genes and proteins that build you a caterpillar can be reused to give you an adult flying insect. As Nobel Prize-winning geneticist Barbara McClintock noted, it's astounding that two brilliantly designed organisms share a single genome. To build a butterfly, you have to be able to assemble a network of elaborate substructures like wings, navigational systems, and a proboscis, and then integrate all these systems into a very complex organism. And you need a cause with an artist's eye for color and pattern and shape. A sense of beauty and aesthetics that extends way beyond utilitarian purposes like camouflage or species recognition. There may well be, in butterflies, aspects of beauty that are there not for the sake of reproduction or survival, but for us to appreciate.
A lot of people I know who study biology do it because they find it beautiful. Natural selection has no reason to produce beauty. Beauty is a sign of the transcendent. It's purely gratuitous. We all recognize it. We just have to acknowledge what it points to.
As human beings, we have a unique gift that enables us to evaluate evidence and then arrive at logical conclusions. That's what science is all about. When you see certain effects in nature, it's your responsibility as an investigator to find the cause that will explain the effect. When you process all the evidence revealed through metamorphosis, and then you ask yourself, in your own experience, what kind of cause could bring about these results? I think the only reasonable answer is an intelligence that transcends the natural world. A designer with foresight and a sense of engineering and artistry, and the ability to light up the sky on a summer afternoon with magnificent evidence that life on Earth is the product of something greater than a blind, undirected process.